Good afternoon, Montreal. Darrell Wiseman here with you again. Our email is info@iapm.ca. In the studio with me, as always, Rick McConomy. And we have a very special show for you today. We've tried over the past number of weeks to show you what individuals can do, regardless of their station in life, regardless of whether they're connected to power, regardless of whether they are have privilege or preference, and how they can make a change in their lives. And today we're going to take you around the world from the international, national, and local levels to show you people and individuals who've done just that. And after a week, frankly, of national news, of incredible, blatant hypocrisies in the Shapiro affair, and the petty narcissisms of the liberals now talking about witch hunts, Rick, about...
Amazing week. It's just wonderful.
Breathing.
They're staggering all over themselves trying to get to the next level of insanity.
Is this the pot calling the kettle black, or is it we need a new expression?
I mean, representative democracy means that you elect somebody and they try and do the right thing, and then you get another shot at them next time around. Imagine an ethics commissioner investigating somebody for making a decision.
Which, of course, he didn't do with Tronic or Bryson or anybody else.
No.
Because that was the guy who appointed him.
The ethics commissioner
is
might
that
consider.
Right,
the ethics commissioner has to consider investigating himself. Like, he should look inward, that probably would bring us to a much higher level in this country.
He got a heart attack. It'd be the picture of Dorian Gray.
You got it.
But can you imagine this thing the past 2 days with the diplomats, the liberals using the word witch hunt after Paul Martin seared, eviscerated the civil service, the political class, his own party? It's staggering what they think they can get away with.
It is amazing when they cloak themselves in that self-righteousness of, my gosh, we never did anything wrong. It reminds me of Duceppe when he said that, you know, all of the patronage should be regional, like the caucus of your region should decide. Like the Bloc Québécois should be hiring all of the federal civil servants in Quebec.
Sure.
Makes good sense
to everybody.
Good logic.
Well, Montreal and everybody listening on the net, we're going to bring you people with a little more honor and a little more conscience than what we've seen in this country. And we're going to be going right after the break to Kabul, and after that to New Delhi. So we beg your indulgence as far as the sound quality from the Kabul interview. And we'll introduce our first guest right after this. So, Montreal, we've gone through a week of absolute nonsense at the national level as usual. The Shapiro affair, all of a sudden our ethics commissioner is going to investigate conservatives on the same things he wouldn't investigate liberals on. And, of course, we've had these wonderful witch hunt comments from the liberals about the diplomats. But perhaps one of the most egregious, one of the most revolting, insulting kind of debates that is going on now in Ottawa was started by the NDP, who want to discuss whether our soldiers should be in Afghanistan. This nation wasn't built on that kind of claptrap and on that kind of cowardice. And with joining us now from Kabul is one of the finest public servants this country has produced in the global sense of the word public servant. And thank God for people like him, because we may just have to give up on the country if there weren't. Writer named Frantz Fanon, who was a great revolutionary writer in the early 60s, said, "As a man, I undertake to face the possibility of annihilation in order that two or three truths may cast their eternal brilliance over the world." Peter Dimitrov has cast several truths in a variety of arenas. He served in the Canadian Forces, finishing as a captain, served as chief of staff at the ministerial level in Ottawa, and decided to join the National Democratic Institute, which is based in Washington, which is involved in nation building, actually structuring those institutions of constitutional liberalism that make democracy possible in failed states. Peter has been on the ground in Kabul for almost 18 months, if I'm not mistaken, and we're proud to have him join us now. Peter, how are you from Kabul?
Very good, Darrell. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for that generous introduction.
All true. I'm glad.
I was a bit surprised. I was wondering who you were going to have on as a guest until I realized it was me.
Well, look in the mirror. It's okay.
Well deserved.
I'm glad our connection's better than it was yesterday. Peter Dimitrov, tell us why it's important for Canada to be nation-building in Afghanistan, and tell us how much success you've had as part of the team and head of the Canadian team that prepared 60,000 workers in the Afghani elections.
Well, I have to admit I agree with your premise. It's a critical for Canada to be here, doing not only the somewhat complex work of nation building, but also in terms of what the military is doing out in the southern region as well. That's absolutely marvelous, quite frankly. You know, if Canada wasn't here, I think we'd be facing a huge credibility problem, because the one thing that the folks back home have to realize is this is also a NATO mission with respect to Canada's military involvement. And so we also have an obligation to, as part of that alliance.
Yes, but it's not just a coalition really, of the willing.
Absolutely not. You know, there are two different types of forces here. We have the coalition forces led by the Americans, which are actively hunting down elements of the Taliban, but then also the NATO commitment. And what Canada is doing here now is certainly still within the NATO remit. However, it's certainly more aggressive, and they're operating in rather more dangerous areas than some of the other NATO forces, which are providing point security and location security within some of the major cities.
So this is really something that buys Canada a place at the table of decision making. It's not something that we're just doing because of some kind of touchy-feely idea of helping somebody else. This really has real results for real people and has a real impact on Canada's voice in the world.
Well, no, absolutely right. And even if it didn't increase our place at the table or voice in the world, it's still the right thing to do. And that's one sort of calculus that doesn't seem to really figure large sometimes in some of the political debates, is the fact that this is a place that desperately needs help. And one, some of the comments I've heard within the debates over the last week and week and a half, 2 weeks, and I just want to interject right here, don't think that those debates that are going on in Canada are not heard here. They're heard loud and clear.
I hope some of the other voices are heard loud and clear there, too, as when General McKenzie says, if we had beam counters at D-Day, we'd never have crossed the channel.
No, absolutely right. And, you know, General Hillier certainly, I think, has been perceived within Canada as a real breath of fresh air, and I must admit he's certainly respected and valued here. He pulls his weight, and because of the fine work of the troops here, his voice is a strong one. So that's a really, I think, a really great accomplishment. But, you know, it's not just the military end of things. As you mentioned, I'm involved in working with the new parliament. We've had our presidential elections, and then last year we had our parliamentary elections. And so really the building blocks of this new state are coming together. It's not perfect, and you certainly hear a lot about some of the warlords and some of the commanders who are present within the political system here, but it's a really hopeful start in many ways. And, you know, the idea that there are some folks now in the parliament here who may have blood in their hands is a reality you have to deal with in Afghanistan.
Pete, I want to get back to this because right after the break, because there are very few people in this country that have been so involved in political organization as Rick McConomy, and I want you to talk a little bit with him and with our audience about exactly how difficult a task it was getting Afghanistan organized with the 60,000 people that were involved in this election. So, Pete, if you just hang on with us, we'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, let's talk right after this. We pay some bills. You've heard the number. Our email is info@iapm.ca, and we're back discussing the importance of Canada's role in nation building in Afghanistan, and our very special guest from Kabul is the country director for the National Democratic Institute, Peter Dimitrov. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Peter, the thing I wanted to ask you to describe for our listeners, it's Rick McConomy in Montreal, is we're talking 60,000 people to organize an election. Isn't it part of our responsibility as a democracy to share in the structuring and helping people to understand really the price that you pay? You have to go through elections. Can you describe some of that, the work that you're doing?
Well, that's a great question, Rick, and thanks for it. You know, the biggest challenge we've had is that realizing that there is a system of governance in this country already. However, it's a tribal system at the very low local levels. And, of course, it's one which is somewhat incompatible with modern concepts of participatory democracy and, as well, Of course, women's rights have to be, of course, somehow safeguarded as well within this tribal system. The biggest thing was changing that mindset, this idea that at the local level, leaders were not entitled to power simply by who they were, but should be for the ideas that they put forth. And in terms of the numbers involved, this was even far greater than what we were doing. The 60,000 you refer to actually refers to the number of people we trained in terms of candidates and their campaign teams. In terms of election workers, if you can believe it, there were over 200,000 people mobilized in this country for the parliamentary elections in September.
With a massive participation and percentage, right?
Absolutely.
Of voters.
The voter percentage dropped slightly from the presidential elections from the year before, but that was because the security situation has slightly degraded. And during the election day, there was some concern about getting out to vote, but those were in isolated areas.
So you're talking about exposing 200,000 people to the idea of an election list and a proper vote and a control and all of those things that are so important.
Rick, I think we need that in Montreal. We have a refresher course in Canada.
I'm sorry, I've been jumping all over you. I was just going to say, even the basic concepts like women going out and voting without being instructed by the elder or the male in their family, the idea of getting the idea that your vote is secret was such a big hurdle to overcome in the presidential elections that we saw a much greater turnout of women for the parliamentary election. That in itself was a real step forward. Now, the elections, of course, are only the journey to getting to the point where we are now, which is starting this new institution of parliament and getting the difficult concept of the balance between powers of the executive versus the legislature versus the judicial. So there's in Canada, we really enjoy a long legacy and tradition. These guys are just starting up, but it's fascinating to be at the ground level, I must admit.
It must really challenge your own commitments to the democracy and the ideas that we have here, that when you try to transfer them, they meet with acceptance or resistance. It must be a very fascinating kind of a life you're living there.
Well, and we try to Afghanize our work as much as possible. We've been here now for 2.5 years, and so we're certainly looked on as a part of the community. But moreover, the profile of the institute is, I think, quite something. We have 140 Afghans spread out over 8 regional centers
I'm glad you made that point. I want Canadians and everybody around the world who's listening to understand that it's not Peter Dimitrov a lone man in the wilderness, but you're running an operation of considerable size that's yeah. building that infrastructure. It's not just you speaking to people ad hominem.
No, these are fairly sophisticated programs. Our current programs train the members of parliament, they train the speaker's office, and they also work with the permanent secretariat staff of the parliament. So it's quite complex, and as I said, there's only 3 internationals working and 140 Afghans, and those 3 internationals are all Canadian as well. So we have a real Canadian contingent here. And, you have to give them the basic tools, but Afghans have to work this out for themselves at the same time. They have a relatively nasty habit of showing visitors the door, so to speak, if they vote state, they're welcome. And now I'm not comparing us or the present military or international presence to the Russians or even the British of a century ago, but, they're a very proud people and they certainly want to help themselves, and they just need a little assistance in doing so.
Peter Dimitrov, stay with us for a few more minutes. We'll be right back with you after this break. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConaughey in studio with me, and we're having a fascinating discussion with Peter Dimitrov, country director for Afghanistan for the National Democratic Institute, the man who oversaw 140 operatives getting Afghanis ready for their elections, and successfully so. Pete, we thank you for staying with us so long. What's the final lesson for Canadians in all this?
Can we really feel very strongly that what's happening in Afghanistan is some kind of a model, the model that the democracies of the West should be bringing to other people? And tell us, is the success rate worth the work that you're doing?
I think that in terms of what we're doing and what the international community is doing here, it is a model, but every situation is going to be a little bit different. I think the support model, the model that is set up by the community, international community to start helping the Afghans, is something that is it can be transplanted, but each individual country is so different that we really have to make allowances for how this is going. In terms of optimism, I think there's a great deal that Canadians, Afghans, and everyone else involved in this, and it truly is the globalization of conflict, if you will, because we have to remember that the 9/11, of course, touched Canadian lives as well, and this is the source of it. I think a lot of people have a great deal of reason to be optimistic. We have now a functioning parliament. We have a lot of the commanders, a lot of the drug barons have laid down their arms, have started to work within the system. And, you know, if the one, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not we'll end up with the return of the Taliban. When you talk to ordinary Afghans, you realize it's simply not possible.
Peter Dimitrov, we thank you for being with us. You've made a hell of a contribution to make democracy work. This is not a time, obviously, for Canada to debate, but to engage. And we thank you for being with us. And
keep up the good work. You're fighting the good fight.
And as Ed Murrow would say, good night where you are, and good luck, and come back safe.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's wonderful, and I appreciate your efforts out there to make that those ideas known and important in terms of staying the course in Afghanistan. I really appreciate it.
Take care, Peter.
Take care, Peter.
Montreal, you've heard what Canada does and how important this mission in Afghanistan is. We're part of NATO. We have a role at the table. We are building freedom in the world. We can't just be bystanders in all this. And we want to hear from you. Do you understand the kind of sacrifice and service that people like Peter Dimitrov are making? Let's hear from you at 7900006. And right now, I want to introduce Robert Galbraith. Bob Galbraith is one of the preeminent war photojournalists around. And this is not a man who pulls any punches. He went to Iraq, and he refused to be embedded with the troops. He refused simply to listen to the news conferences that the army would give. He went into the streets at great personal risk, produced a remarkable book called Iraq, Eyewitness to War, a photojournalist's diary, and unlike many of the media, came back despite the toll and the tragedy he saw on the people, making people understand the importance of engagement, and in this case today, the importance of our Kandahar mission, where Robert is seeking to get back to do another study. Robert Galbraith, welcome.
How are you doing today?
Very well.
Great to speak with you and listeners.
Bob, you heard Peter Dimitrov talk about the importance of Canada's role as part of NATO in Afghanistan. I know you're looking to get back there. What convinced you that this kind of engagement is important and that the kind of debates we're having in Canada as to whether we should be in or out are really frivolous?
No, they're not frivolous at all. The more information we have out to the public, available to the public, will help inform the public on the right decisions. And I feel personally that Canadians, until a couple of weeks ago, were pretty laid back on the events unfolding in Afghanistan. Many people said to me, why are we in there fighting America's war? So
that's what I meant by the frivolous part, that our importance was not underlined by our politicians.
No,
right?
Until
Prime Minister Harper's election.
No, I got to congratulate the Conservatives for taking the moves that they're making now with the Canadian Armed Forces, not only to bolster the forces, but to give a greater morale within our troops. They felt, personally speaking to the troops, they were sort of like letter carriers. Nobody really cared as long as the mail showed up in the box. But now we're starting to see greater exposure through the media and through our politicians of the importance of the mission in Afghanistan.
Robert Galbraith, stay with us as we pay some bills. Montreal, we want to hear from you about the importance of Kandahar and nation building around the world. We'll be back right after this. Montreal, we're talking about the importance of Canada's role in Afghanistan, Canada's participation in democratic development in the world. And we have on the line with us Robert Galbraith, one of the premier war photojournalists around, who is the author of Iraq, Eyewitness to War, and is now preparing to go to Afghanistan to do a similar study of the Canadian war effort there. Bob, I got to ask you this question.
Yes.
You put your ass in the line once. Why again so soon?
I don't know. It's a sort of internal drive I have, and I don't want to sound sort of syrupy about this, but I love to
be syrupy. It's all right. Well, you've earned your syrupy stripes.
Yeah. Well, I'm in this business for money. I'm in it for personal goal, but I get a real thrill out of when I give a public talk like I did this week, last week in Westmount.
And which you'll be doing, by the way, just let me tell Montreal, which you'll be doing at a conference that the Institute of Public Affairs is putting on next Saturday. On the Middle East, and you get more information on that by emailing info@iepm.ca. Go ahead, Bob.
But when it's after the talk and people come up to me and start talking with me and describing to me how I had opened their mind and opened their view of what's going on in Afghanistan, and they were much more able to make a value judgment on whether we should or shouldn't be there, which is usually should be there after I speak with them and offer up my suggestions for what I've seen on the street in Afghanistan. That's the biggest thrill of it all, is to spread information, spread knowledge, and keep people more informed, more or less like a radio show like you're doing now. This is very important.
Bob, hang on with us. We've got Barry on line one. Barry, welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well.
Super good.
Fighting the good fight.
I just want to say that I'm all for Canadian forces being involved. What I really object to is when they're put under control of the United Nations, when they're hogtied by the United Nations, or when they're put into harm's
way. In other words, you don't mind when, as General McKenzie would say, when we're war fighters, not peacekeepers. It's when we're peacekeepers that we're hamstrung.
Well, it's not peacekeepers. I think when what the UN does, and especially like UNIFIL, when they allow the Lebanese or the terrorists in southern Lebanon to commit atrocities and not prevent them, yet they go ahead and they scream bloody murder whenever the Israelis try to defend themselves. That's what I'm against. If there's going to be a Pax Canadianis type of thing, then I'm all for it. I think that our volunteer army is probably amongst the best in the world. If they're given the green light to go ahead and do their job.
Barry, you made a very important point. I'd like Rick and Bob to comment on this. I don't know if any of you read this, but yesterday, former Spanish Prime Minister Aznar, on this question of NATO and the ability of NATO member states to have their armies really do effective jobs, called for the inclusion of Israel into NATO as a signal to Iran that if Iran's going to try something, we got a serious frontline member state. What do you all think of that?
Go ahead.
Anybody? You're all essouffled. You're all winded with that.
Yeah.
This was big news in Europe yesterday.
Well, it seems there's a taking of sides that has to happen, I guess, at some point in time. I mean, you got to cross the Rubicon. You got to make the move, and you got to make the decision. I think the idea of the mandate that Barry's talking about is to be clear as to the mandate that we're carrying. And if it is one where we're going to be complaining that our troops are out there with no bullets in the guns, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense at all.
We got Andy on line one. Andy, welcome.
Hello there. I was listening to the gentleman that talked about Afghanistan. Now, I think it's a great idea. It's a fantastic idea that the Canadians are going there to help. But we're forgetting one thing, which is their idea of way of living conflicts with ours. So if we try to put on democracy in our parliamentary system, most of the people will be against it.
But wait a minute, that's not at all what the proof has shown, what Mr. Dimitrov has shown.
Oh, no.
Is that the parliamentary elections were a great success,
yes,
and they are turning a country around. You can't say that just because the Taliban took over that you have to leave a country under the terrorist regime.
No, I didn't say that. But this thing has to go very slow because the mindset of those people is based on a different, the culture is different, and if you push it or you try to do it too fast, it's going to backfire.
I think Peter Dimitrov clearly stated that what he is doing is something that's at the grassroots. He's got hundreds of thousands of people engaged in getting the job done and beginning to participate. He also pointed out very clearly that this is adjusted to the reality on the ground. It wouldn't work otherwise. But Andy, I think you're right. We've got to be careful not to impose our values on other people. But the reality is, I think Peter is working the side of the street that he should be on.
Andy, thanks very much. And Bob Galbraith, I'd like your comment on what Andy had to say right after this. Montreal, we're talking about nation-building, Canada assuming its proportionate share, its proper share of engagement in democratic development around the world. We're talking about Canadian heroes like Peter Dimitrov on the ground in Kabul. Journalist Bob Galbraith is on the phone with us right now, author of Iraq, Eyewitness to War. Bob Galbraith, are we imposing or are we liberating?
Well, no.
Just to answer the last caller.
We're liberating, and we also, while we must be careful not to rush in too fast and try to perhaps bring our culture or our democratic beliefs into Afghanistan, we also got to be careful that the more we ponder over what to do and what not to do, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are using this as free time to regroup. And we must keep in mind that it's early spring in Afghanistan right now. The Afghani people are not outward towards the cold winter months like Canadians going skiing, tobogganing.
So we've got Jack Layton calling for debate. Meanwhile, the Taliban are organizing.
Yeah, exactly.
And Layton thinks they're going to wait for him to finish the debate in a nice, gentlemanly fashion.
That's
Bob,
right.
Stay with us because we got Tooney on the line who's not happy about something. Tooney, welcome.
Yes, sir. I'd like to remind you a few facts.
Sure.
Do you remember the 300 babies that were thrown out of the incubators in Kuwait that President Bush's father said that then after it was a lie? You remember that?
Well, actually, it wasn't a lie. It's documented in the United Nations.
No, sir. No,
yes,
no,
sir.
No, no, sir.
Yes, sir.
No, no,
get
no,
your facts
sir.
Right.
What's
your problem?
My problem.
Tell me, you like dictators in power who kill 300,000 of their own people a year? Do you like dictators in power who gas Kurdish villages and kill 60,000 at a time? Or you think that's okay and that's morally relative to what Western responsibilities are? I suggest you go and read the Nuremberg Principles.
Sir, who put Saddam Hussein in power?
Saddam Hussein put Saddam Hussein in power.
No, sir.
Tooney, go back to your history. Saddam Hussein led a Ba'ath revolution. Yes, he was backed by the United States in the war against Iran. What's your problem? Because you back somebody yesterday and becomes a murderer today, you're still supposed to back him? What kind of political equivalency is that? That's the kind of thinking that screws up the minds of most young people in this country. You can't, you can have a friend who today is your best friend and tomorrow goes out and rapes your wife. Is that your fault for encouraging him to rape your wife?
Can I talk? As soon as you start talking sense,
I'll stop.
Oh, what I don't agree with is nonsense.
Has nothing to do with agreement. Has to do with rationality and reason over idiotic theocratic passion. Listen to me. Just because there are borders on a nation does not give you sovereignty. Okay. Sovereignty is earned through the legitimacy of transparency, constitutional liberalism, and freedom. And don't you dare try and make an argument, not on this show, that bloodlines of familial descent or accidents of geographic boundaries give anybody protection against the imposition of nations who come to the aid of oppressed peoples. If there's one thing that came out of a century of blood, one thing that made 100 years of 80 million people dying in Russia, in China, throughout Europe, it's the Nuremberg Principles that mandate Western nations, free nations, to go in and overthrow tyrants. And by the way,
Hallelujah.
Canada,
Hallelujah.
That sponsored
Hallelujah.
The International
Hallelujah.
Committee on State Sovereignty,
Hallelujah.
Came up with the idea of Hallelujah. Responsibility to protect. And that's what we're doing in the Middle East. So don't you dare try to make that kind of an argument.
And where is the arms of mass destruction in Iraq?
The arms, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, first of all, were sent out of Iraq 3 months before the invasion. Bush was wrong in not standing up and saying, we're going to Iraq to take down a tyrant because we have the right and obligation to do that. He should have said it. But the fact that he used the wrong reasons does not delegitimize the invasion.
Yes, sir. Very good. Okay. And what are we doing in Afghanistan now?
What are we doing? We're trying to, as you heard Peter Dimitrov say, we are installing the democratic institutions necessary to go forward and protecting the people from the crazy Talibans who would do things like cut off women's heads for sleeping with other men and cut off the right arms of children who steal bread in the markets. I think that's a pretty good reason for Western armies to be there. And if you don't, I would suggest you reconsider your own moral plane. Thank you, and we'll be back after this. We're back, Montreal, talking about what Canada's appropriate role should be in the world and having the courage to go and do it. Rick McConaughey's in the studio with me. Bob Galbraith, photojournalist, author of Iraq Eyewitness to War, is on the line with us. Bob, I know your schedule's tight, but I wanted to get your reaction to that last caller.
Well, all I can say, I wish that man could have walked in the footsteps where I've walked, covering conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, and so on and so forth. Conspiracy theorists like this and people who don't reach out to grab the root of information and to explore the situations themselves, be it this man with what happened in Kuwait or be it with Osama bin Laden's family being flown out of the United States and the reasons behind that, it just bogs us down, clouds the water, and people like the former caller are caught in a whirlpool of hate and ignorance, and they should really explore their homework and quit bringing up stuff that's... Let's advance in this. Let's bring a fresh breath like we're trying to now with our government and
let's advance indeed. Robert J. Galbraith, thank you for being with us.
I also want to say my deepest thoughts are with all the members of our Canadian Armed Forces and their families.
Absolutely.
God bless them all.
Absolutely. And
thank you, Robert.
Robert Galbraith's book, Iraq Eyewitness to War, a photojournalist diary, is available at Better Bookstores. I highly recommend it, and he will be speaking at an institute conference in the Middle East this Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel downtown. We are now going to New Delhi.
But before we just want to say, Tony, you called in, you took your shot, Beryl got a little gone, but that's what this is all about, okay?
That was a shot.
Basically, I think Robert said it all. We have to start getting to the point where we're agreeing on the data. We're stopping with the anecdotes. We're stopping with the irrelevant. We're stopping with the conspiracy theories and get in behind our troops and in behind our people that are out there doing good things in Afghanistan and around the world. And we've got to keep going, Beryl, and we got to just keep covering these things.
I engage in debate with Tooney, don't you think?
I thought you were very polite. I thought you just held back.
I held back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could see you. You could do worse. You could do worse.
You've seen me do worse.
Oh, I've heard you do worse. It's frightening.
From New Delhi, welcome and welcome. Thank you for your patience, Professor Madhav Nalapat. How are you?
Very well indeed, Barry.
Professor, let me first introduce you to our audience. Professor Nalapat, though he holds no official position in the Indian government and has been editor of the Times of India and is a professor of geopolitics at the elite Manipal Academy of Higher Education, has been called by some India's Kissinger. Behind the scenes over the past 18 months, he has formed a network that was responsible, finally, in last week's signing of the U.S.-Indian nuclear agreement, which has created, I think, a new balance of influence, a new sphere of influence in Asia. We are dealing with a new and a real Asian tiger in India today. But Professor Nalapat is also concerned with a number of other issues that people don't think normally would affect the subcontinent, among them being India's relations not so much with Pakistan, but even with Iran, and the lack of understanding of how the Wahhabism, the Saudi form of radical Islamism, is making its way east and affecting India. So with that lengthy but well-deserved introduction, Professor Nalapat, welcome.
Thank you.
What's the number one benefit of the American-Indian agreement of last week?
Well,
both to India and geopolitically to the area.
Well, actually, Beryl, the U.S.-India engagement has expanded way beyond the two governments. I mean, you have millions of people from both countries visiting each other. You have thousands of companies now linking up with each other. You have about 90,000 Indian students who are now studying in U.S. campuses. I mean, Indians are the largest segment of students in U.S. campuses, much more than the Chinese.
That's
now
correct.
And you have a huge lot of engagement taking place that's quite outside government. As a matter of fact, I believe that the less government-to-government engagement there is, the better. Because we have a Cold War history in India. We, of course, you know that we backed the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And the United States has a history of backing Pakistan, which has been not very friendly to India for all the years that we have been a free country. So I think the less government-to-government there is, the more people-to-people, the more business-to-business, the more university-to-university, and the more talk show-to-talk show, the better.
You make a very interesting point. Do you think, are we moving, and you're far closer to the statistics than I am, are we moving to seeing Western countries who are looking for less expensive
labor markets to be using or to be more inclined to use India, which is a functioning democracy, rather than China? Is there being a shift on the economic front?
Well, Beryl, the way I see it now that, you know, we're having the knowledge economy, and the knowledge economy is very different from, let's say, producing ships or producing machine tools. Now, there, China was very good. You know, they have very good infrastructure. They work like ants. They work like beavers. But in the knowledge economy, you essentially need a free mind. You need free expression. For that, I think you need political democracy and you need liberal culture. And the Chinese are faltering out there, and they're not able to overtake India in the knowledge economy, even though their infrastructure, their physical infrastructure is way better than ours, their mental infrastructure, because of the fact that the political system is so rigid, and because of the fact that we are relatively more liberal than they are. I mean, our knowledge infrastructure is far better. So the reality today is that it's not a question of expensive or cheap.
And when you say knowledge, we're talking about call centers and computer-related backup systems.
You know, I'm talking about the whole gamut
brain power
of services. You know, I'm brain power. I mean, when you use a mobile phone, when you use a computer, when you use a telephone, in almost everything now you've got embedded knowledge. And I'm talking about the software in those systems. And
Professor,
that's where I think...
bear with us for one moment. We're just going to pay some bills. Be right back with you. Montreal, good afternoon. In studio with Rick McConomy. On the line from New Delhi, Professor Manav Malapat. Often called India's Kissinger, the man who started the wheels turning for the American-Indian nuclear agreement. And we've been talking about the growth of India as an economic marketplace because it's a free system as opposed to China. And, Professor, do you have any concerns that freedom could be compromised by what's happening on the borders of Pakistan or what's happening in Iran right now, that there are other priorities that are going to come up that might thwart the economic development in India?
You know, Beryl, I was listening very closely to the last half hour of your discussion. I think it was a very lively discussion. And I just want
Rick
to say
doesn't
that,
think so. He thought I was too calm.
No, I think you were great, and I think that it's good that we have this cut and thrust of free debate. The whole point is that whether it's liberty, whether it's, you know, having your own way in the sense of having the right to have your views heard. Now, this is something which every human being wants, and in that sense, these are universal values. Now, in India, for example, we've had a tradition of being under British rule, and we have the Westminster-style parliamentary system. We have about 300 million people who speak English, I mean, at least some form of English or the other. Mm-hmm. And my point is very simple. My point is that when you're looking, for example, at immigration, you know, if you're looking at people who are fluent in modern language, who are fluent in modern technology, and who can be productive from the day they land on your shores, then frankly, unlike the Europeans who are looking next door, you need to look at people who are culturally next door. And my view is someone from Chennai or Hyderabad in India who's had 300 or 400 years of dealing with the West, dealing with the British, and dealing with modern, you know, Westminster-style systems for the last 70 and odd years would probably be better than maybe someone from Albania or from Romania.
Let me ask the opposite question.
Right.
The opposite question comes on as, how is the knowledge economy affecting the building either of a middle class or of those 300 million people that are there? Is this benefiting across the population, or is it like a meritocracy or a limited knowledge group that's getting the benefit from this?
Beryl, it's not limited, because now people who can study the language, who can study English language, are now getting into the knowledge economy. And we find in some of the states that are backward economically in India, where the study of English was banned by the local governments because of public pressure, even the schools that are owned by government are now being forced to teach English. So we find that the number of people who are demanding quality education for their children and who are demanding the opportunity to get into the knowledge economy is expanding every year. And therefore, today, we have a huge constituency of more than 300 million people who favor economic reform. Now, this has made economic reform irreversible.
What you're saying, though, touches on a very important issue that we discussed last week with Ambassador Martin Collicott. He's a former Canadian diplomat with the Fraser Institute, who released a report that made a lot of headlines that said that Canada is vulnerable to terrorism because it does not call on its immigrants to accept the pluralism of the democracy and liberalism of our society. Exactly what you're saying is necessary for new immigrants to India. It's fascinating to hear the same views from New Delhi and from Vancouver.
Well, I think what he was talking about, this is Rick McConomy in Montreal, what he was talking about was the immigration to Canada of these people. They come with a value system that is ours, and it certainly fits in with what we were talking about last week.
Is this a major problem that you foresee right now, Professor?
Well, let me give an example. I mean, you know, you have a lot of knocking of Israel, and you have a lot of people in Canada who knock Israel pretty regularly. But if you go to Tel Aviv, you find a mosque there. Now, you go anywhere in Saudi Arabia, you don't find a synagogue, and you don't even find a Shia mosque. In the east of
Jewish, you can't get a visa to Saudi Arabia, but that's another issue.
I mean, if you're Israeli, you certainly can't get a visa. If you're American, then you can get a visa. But in the entire east of Saudi Arabia, which is where 90% of the oil is, the people are Shias, and they are denied any kind of rights, religious rights at all. They're not allowed to practice their religion. They are treated like third-class citizens, and they're completely humiliated. Now, you know, going back to Afghanistan, one of the major problems that I'm seeing in Afghanistan is the closeness of the United States to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. The Army of Pakistan has got jihad as its motto. The Army of Pakistan trained the Taliban. Saudi Arabia funded the Taliban. And these two people, unfortunately, have a very great deal of influence in telling the Americans who the friends are.
Professor, stay with us on this, and we're going to discuss the influence of the Wahhabi establishment and explain it to our audience right after we pay some bills. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. Email at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking with Professor Nadav Malapat from New Delhi.
And don't be afraid. It's 790-0006. I'll hold Beryl.
I was worried about repeating the number twice, and, you know, because the phone's already burning up, and I want to get to Professor Malapat again. Professor Malapat was just making the point of destabilization in the area and the potential influence on Afghanistan, and even in Pakistan, of the Wahhabi Islamist establishment. And perhaps for our listeners, before we get back to the professor, we should explain that in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi clerical establishment has control of departments of the government and control of a great deal of money that they use for funding, and they have in the past admittedly used it to fund al-Qaeda and others. And we were just discussing the threat that this poses to the stability of the Afghanistan-Pakistan-India border region. So we're back with you, Professor Malapat.
Yeah, well, you know, Beryl, any holy book of any religion has got some parts that are pretty violent, some parts that are pretty intolerant, and a lot of other parts that are pretty humane and very liberal. And the Muslim religion and the Quran are the same. Now, the Wahhabis, what they have done is take the more violent parts of the Quran, the parts of the Quran that deal rather negatively with other religions such as Christians and Jews, and ignore the many parts that are friendly to Christians and Jews and even friendly to other faiths. Now, they're absolute extremists, and in my view, Wahhabis are not Muslims at all. Unfortunately, they run Saudi Arabia, not just a few departments. They run the entire government of Saudi Arabia, and they have been since they had this alliance with the royal family of Saudi Arabia several hundred years ago. Now, take Afghanistan once again. You had a Northern Alliance there, which was headquartered in Mazar-e-Sharif. In the land controlled by Northern Alliance, women were free. They could dress as they liked. They could work, and there was no Sharia law. What happened after 9/11, when the U.S. started bombing, the Northern Alliance wanted to expand its territory. Initially, the Americans were reluctant to allow them to march. Then they wanted to enter Kabul. The Americans did not want them to enter Kabul. Finally, the Americans stopped them from moving to the south of Afghanistan. And that's precisely the zone where the Taliban and Osama bin Laden and others are very strong. If Mr. bin Laden is alive today, and if the Taliban is still a force today, it's because the Americans listened to the Saudis and the Pakistanis and did not allow the Northern Alliance to move up to the borders of Afghanistan. It's because even today, the United States administration, unfortunately, regards Saudi Arabia and Pakistan as the experts of the Islamic world.
And that's the fascinating thing about the way you've structured this alliance of democracies, not only between India and America, or helped to structure, but including Israel in it. But you've warned, you've cautioned, that even though there is an alliance of interests of free states, India should not necessarily be allied with any one state in any permanent position, but should have the flexibility to move as it needs to in response to regional pressures of the kind you're describing.
Well, Beryl, so far as Israel is concerned, I think, you know, initially in India, I must confess, in the 60s and all that, we were a little negative to the idea because we had a religious state formed in near, you know, out of India, which is Pakistan. And therefore, we were temperamentally opposed to another religious state. Although the fact is, later on we realized the circumstances of Israel are completely different. For one thing, the Jewish people have gone through such enormous suffering over thousands of years that very definitely they've earned the right to their own state. So Israel is, in a sense, in a category by itself, and you have to judge it in a category by itself. Of course, in the middle of the 80s, we had Rajiv Gandhi in power, and I had the good fortune of being a good friend of Rajiv Gandhi, and I was a good friend of Narasimha Rao, who succeeded him. And I know that Rajiv wanted to establish relations with Israel, official relations with Israel. We discussed that several times, but unfortunately he was warned by so-called political experts that would inflame, quote-unquote, Muslim opinion, and he never crossed.
And these are the
line.
Developments over the years that have brought us to where we are today with the basic independence. I remember when I was a student in the 60s and we would talk about the neutrality of India. I want to thank you very much for this. It's been very, very enlightening.
Professor Nalapat, we were going to have you on again. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you.
You too.
We'll be right back to discuss the Canadian political scene right after this. Montreal, welcome back. Rick McConomy in studio with me, 7900006. Email info@iapm.ca. We've been talking to some very heroic people today. Peter Dimitrov, nation building in Afghanistan with the National Democratic Institute. A photojournalist, Bob Galbraith, author of Iraq, Eyewitness to War and the Importance of Canada's Mission in Kandahar. Professor Madhav Nalapat from New Delhi, who's building an alliance of democracies in a new Asian tiger. And I want to welcome Angela Persicelli from Toronto, who's the columnist for the Hill Times, who's our own homegrown kind of hero. Angela, welcome. But before we get into discussion about what's been going on this week, this is a man who pulls no punches. He's one of the most refreshing writers on the national political scene. And just to read you one thing he wrote at the end of January after the election, what happens when you put together unlimited ambitions, vulgar arrogance, and unmitigated incompetence? A liberal defeat. Angela Persicelli, welcome to The Last Angry Man.
Thanks for inviting me.
A pleasure.
Rick McConomy.
Angelo, what a week it's been. Angelo, first of all, let's talk to this Shapiro business. And all of a sudden, the ethics commissioner has woken up? Where was he with Bryson? Where was he with Stronach?
Well, I think that the initiative that he's has started last week confirms what was said about him all along. I'm a bit surprised, though, that Stephen Harper is taking him seriously. And I believe that he was supposed just to say, okay, go ahead, do what you have to do. But challenging him, I think that he's giving him credibility. He's giving this initiative credibility. And
has he challenged him, or has he just said kind of, you know, screw off, I'm not talking to you?
Well, you know, I would have gone along. He's still the ethics commissioner. And I believe that Stephen Harper had nothing to hide. He did what he had to do. And we can discuss maybe later on the comparison between what he has done and what Paul Martin has done with Belinda Stronach and what Stephen Harper has done with David Emerson. But I believe that had he told him, okay, do you want to talk to me? I'm ready to talk to you, and let's see what you want to do. And I believe that he would have gained a lot of prime ministerial attitude, because until he's there.
Yeah, but doesn't he empower him by doing that? Doesn't he empower him by speaking with him? And obviously, this guy's a hack that was put in there by the liberals. I mean, the background on some of the
wrong
litigation.
Everything was a joke since the beginning. And the fact that he puts under an inquiry Stephen Harper. And, you know, there is something really important to understand. During the election, Jason Kenney wrote a letter to the commissioner asking to inquire Tony Valeri and the land deal in Hamilton. And the answer that Shapiro, and this is important for two reasons. One, the date. The letter he sent back to Jason Kenney on January 23rd, in this letter he was saying, basically, unfortunately I cannot do any inquiry because by the time the parliament is dissolved, until they go back to work, I have no power because there are no MPs.
Which was nonsense. Which was nonsense and just an arrogant response because his work can be going on.
Well, but my point is, if he cannot inquire MPs after the dissolution of the parliament until the parliament reconvenes, why he wants now to inquire MPs right in the same period?
Precisely. That was leading me to my next question. What you've heard overnight, you know, from people like even Stefan de Jong calling the supposed recall of certain diplomats as a witch hunt. Does liberal arrogance never stop? They have a right to talk about a witch hunt when they destroyed a party, ruined reputations, compromised fundamental charter protection rights, and named their own diplomats. I mean, does it never stop with these guys?
Well, I think that Stefan de Jong should ask the same question to Alan Rock and Frank McKenna. Because Frank McKenna, when he announced his resignations, he said, I believe it's appropriate to resign because the new prime minister, it's fair for a new prime minister to have in those positions people that he trusts. So this
exactly.
is not a conservative saying that they should resign. It's the former Canadian ambassador to the United States.
But aren't there some democracies where all of those types of appointments are subject to a resignation and either a reconfirmation or a replacement?
But there is something, though, that I'm a bit confused when we talk about this. We talk about patronage, let's face it. The ability, I don't dispute the ability of those people, but definitely they were appointed because it was a kind of payback or because they were working for the party. The Liberal Party.
But it becomes a mutual philosophical meeting place where the people think and feel the same way as the people that appoint them.
But you know what concerns me about what Mr. Harper is doing, though? Is he against the fact that they are political appointees, or he's against the fact that they were not, you know, he complains because they were not good? Because there is something that I'm a bit confused, because he has appointed Michael Wilson, and he's a person that I have a lot of respect, personal and professional, and honest and competent. There is everything there. But still, he was the co-chair of the Conservative campaign in Ontario. And my problem is, if we have governments that last 1 year, 1 year and a half, are we going to change our ambassador in an important state, in a country like United States, every year, year and a half? I think that we don't look good.
Angelo, hold on, and we'll come back and discuss more on that question right after this break. Welcome back, Montreal. We're on with Angelo Persicelli, who's joining us from Toronto. Hill Times columnist talking about everything from Shapiro to the diplomats and all this liberal stuff that all of a sudden they're trying to reverse their own deflowering. Things that they did were okay. Things that are being done now are not so okay. Angela, you're making a point about your concern on the diplomatic front.
Yes, I'm concerned because we go ahead and making those changes, and I don't believe it's good for the country. On the other hand, really, I'm really upset when I hear those comments from the Liberals because, you know, honestly, I don't think that they have the moral authority to make those kind of criticism. But, you know, at the same time, I have that concern.
Angelo, isn't it the fact that the balance of the professionals that are in these offices around the world are actually running the thing? And what you're doing is you're changing the symbol or you're changing the titular head. You know, it's just you take one leading Canadian, you put another leading Canadian. One happens to be a Liberal, one happens to be a Conservative. There's a level of that stuff. Wasn't Kim Campbell named by
John
Chrétien?
Chrétien, 94.
Yes.
And you know, it's a very special thing, these kinds of nominations. I wanted to know from you, though, Angelo, if you could have one of these, which one would you take?
And you can't have the Vatican.
Well, and not Denmark.
Not Denmark. Okay. I'm going to go for Boston. I'm a Montreal Irish. I could do in Boston. Boston, I do well.
Angelo Persicelli, thank you very much for taking time out from a Sunday. I recommend to all our listeners across Ontario and Quebec, pick up the Hill Times,
Pick up Cody Yudhikidze Daisy, where he writes also, this is one of the finest political commentators in the country, a man who pulls no punches. Angelo, mille grazie. Thank you very much.
True, but I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure and in time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
And joining us now is Senator Consigliere Donnino from Toronto. Senator Donnino, how are you?
First of all, I didn't recognize Angelo with all of the applause that you gave him.
Well, you know, we've already applauded you.
We haven't run out, if you're good.
If you're really good.
Is Angelo still there?
No, I think he hung up.
Oh, that's too bad, because I was going to, give him a little bit of a hard time.
We did that. Con.
He's been a friend of mine for a long time.
I know that. Con Donnino, help us.
Hello there, Beryl Wiseman.
Help us out of this. Canada, this is one of the finest men in the Senate. And a man who can't stomach hypocrisy almost as much as I can't. Help me out. I mean, a week with Shapiro, a week with this nonsense from Dion about a witch hunt. I mean, we really have a prime minister. We've got a leader finally in this country who's brooking no nonsense. And we've got all these Lilliputians running around doing their hypocrisy.
I don't think Canadians are going to fall for this. I think you and I share that opinion. Canadians are going to see, I think, something different than they have in the past. You don't have to love this guy. You don't even have to like him. All you got to do is listen and watch, and he's going to govern this country in a way that it hasn't been governed probably in the century, certainly not in my lifetime, which is nearly the century, not quite, but nearly. And what you have to do is look at him, see what he's going to do, see what differences he's going to make to this country, and I'm going to predict on your show, Beryl Wiseman, that the next election he's going to win a majority government because I think we're seeing
a leader who's actually leading. You know, Angelo made the point that he thought that politically perhaps a prime minister should have at least played along, and I said to Angelo, why should he play along? By not even answering him, he's saying, screw off. It's not even in your purview. Do your job, which you didn't do for a year and a half. Do your job, which you said to a House Commons committee. I can't quite get the theory and the practicality right. Do your job by not speaking to the press about investigations undergoing on a conservative MP named Deepak Obray, for which he was held in contempt of the House of Commons. So, you know, my comment to Angela was, this is a prime minister who's leading on whatever issue it is.
When
he stands up and he says, yeah, you know, Hamas is democratically elected, but let him renounce violence to be legitimate. When he stands up and he says to the press, you'll see me when I have something to say. We finally have a leader.
Senator, thanks for coming on our show, Senator. You can listen to Beryl all afternoon.
Yeah.
Rick's yanking my crank again.
Absolutely. Beryl, shut up for a while.
Okay.
Ditto.
Here's a guy who also I admire for the commitment he's made to our troops in Afghanistan, the commitment that he's made to support them, the commitment that he's made to respect them. What's this wishy-washy junk that's coming out of the mouths of some of the liberals, or some Canadians, for that matter of fact? We should be ashamed.
We were talking about that earlier, Layton's call for...
I mean, I don't know you were talking about it or not, but certainly if I'm going to have my piece, I want to tell you that for a lot of Canadians, and I think that'll increase substantially as the time goes by, Stephen Harper is gaining respect. Stephen Harper is not going to be your usual mealy-mouthed kind of politician, and frankly some of our other conservative politicians haven't been quite as straightforward and incorrect, if you wish, in the right manner as Stephen Harper has, and I applaud him for it.
And some of us think that that'll go a long way in Quebec without having to go through all of the BS of fiddling around with the constitutional issue. If he takes a good leadership tack and he shows confidence, I think the people here are going to follow him also.
Senator Donnino, stay with us. We're just going to pay some bills, but certainly we have a prime minister who, as General McKenzie would say, is not a bean counter and would have led it and leads and doesn't follow. We'll be right back right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConney in studio with me, Senator Consigliere Donnino from Toronto, and we're talking leadership, and we're talking about the fact that we actually have a prime minister who leads, and unlike the French revolutionary who excused himself from a cocktail party and said, I have to go to see which way the mob is going so that I could lead them, is actually leading.
Senator, how long do you think this government has to go?
I want to pick up on your point for a moment, though, before you get into that. I think that what Harper has done in Quebec is a perfect example of what I think he will do for the rest of Canada. He started an honest dialogue with them. He didn't sugarcoat the problem. He started to talk to them a couple of years back. People said, you're wasting your time. And he focused and he persevered. And together with Jean Charest, who, as you know, is my ACT leader as well, they've started an honest debate on the issues to a degree that we got 10 seats in Quebec, which was a miracle in the minds of most people, and yet Stephen Harper felt all the time that he could win a bunch of seats in Quebec. And I think that's going to grow a great deal because of the kind of guy he is, because of the leadership that he has shown, because he is a leader. I agree with you, Beryl. Now, how long is this thing going to last? It may last a lot longer than people think if Stephen Harper continues to perform the way he is, because nobody's going to challenge him if his popularity, as I expect it will, continues to increase. Now, if he falls and slips and hurts himself, well, the Liberals may think that they have an opportunity, but I'm saying that it'll be a couple of years, maybe even as long as three.
There may come a point where he's going to want to call an election just to be able to consolidate his position.
Yeah, but he's not going to do it. You see, I don't think Stephen Harper is that kind of a man. Leadership doesn't need that. If he can govern, he will continue to govern. If he can make a contribution to the society of this country, if he can do the kinds of things that need to be done, the tough things that need to be done in this country, and get the support, I think he will continue to do that.
Senator Consigliere Nonino Khan, thank you very much for taking time out. I know you were at a function, and it's always a pleasure to have you here, and we'll talk to you again.
My pleasure. Don't get too hungry, angry. Get hungry as well, but
it's all right. I'll keep the control.
Hey, you know, ever since Chorus chose the name of this show, it's been just a changed man. What can I tell you, Con? You remember me as a calm person.
Oh, absolutely. When was that? When you were born?
We think so. Before. We think so. We're not sure.
Long before he was born, he was a calm person.
Have a good day, guys.
Okay, Con, you too.
Good to see you.
We want to welcome right now Jason McDevitt to do a follow-up on a story we did 2 weeks ago on the casino. Jace, welcome to the program again.
How you doing?
Jason McDevitt is the chair of the CLSC Points in Charles, who led the citizens group against the casino move into Points in Charles. And, of course, this week the Colombe Report came down and said, we think that the social problems are real. This is a neighborhood in Montreal that has a lot of problems, unemployment and other matters, and we agree there's a risk there to be more a problem than a solution and more study needs to happen. The day after the Colombe Report, of course, Cirque du Soleil pulled out of the project. You must feel somewhat gratified by all the effort that you've put into this, Jace.
Oh, absolutely. And when the report first came out, it was it was lukewarm. It wasn't an absolute no. And we were really worried that this was going to drag on for years with additional studies and that it would be hard to keep people motivated. So, we're thrilled. I mean, we had a public...
And you should be. I mean, this is an example, Montreal, of one man leading a citizens group... Little ties, little privilege, little preference, and they made their point.
Congratulations, Jason. We wanted to call you and say exactly that.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, the citizens are thrilled, and I really think that was, played a major role in this not going ahead.
Now, since we're coming up to St. Paddy's Day, we got to point out that you are actually native fighting Boston Irish.
That's the truth.
We need more fight in Montreal. Because we can get things done just like you did.
You may lead the parade next year, Jason. You never know. You're Grand Marshal from the people.
You know, McConomy here is a former Grand Marshal. This is dangerous.
So this is a conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy. It's an Irish conspiracy.
Now let's go and build some low-cost housing on that area before some other sucker comes along with another bright project.
Montreal, the lesson of the Jason McDevitts of the world, but particularly in this case, is that you stand up, you organize, you scream your bloody head off, you get mad and say you're not going to take it anymore. And you can win the day. In a time of universal deceit, merely telling the truth is an act of great heroism. Jason McDevitt, we congratulate you, Montreal. Thank you for listening. Info at iapm.ca, and we'll be back with you next week.
Fight the good fight.